Welcome to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast. My name is Cheryl.
And I'm June.
In today's show, we're going to cover how the science of deception relates to the Michael Jackson allegations.
You can find all source material for this episode on our website, MichaelJacksonCaseForInnocence.com.
Voice actor Derek Black returns to help us narrate this episode.
In the last few episodes, you heard our case for discrediting the Leaving Neverland documentary. We concluded that you can't trust the stories of the two accusers, so it's unfair to use their stories to judge Jackson's guilt or innocence. We also showed how Leaving Neverland did not measure up to accepted documentary standards of fairness.
But when Leaving Neverland aired on HBO back in 2019, all major U.S. media outlets gave universally positive reviews of it, saying that the stories Wade Robson and James Safechuck told of abuse by Michael Jackson were compelling and credible and should be heard. Here's a quote from the TV review in Variety.
Leaving Neverland offers devastatingly powerful and convincing testimony that Michael Jackson was guilty of child sex abuse.
The review in the Washington Post calls the film riveting and sharply convincing, and also states the following.
A devastating and credible Leaving Neverland will turn you off of Michael Jackson for good.
In a review in the Chicago Tribune, calls the movie
seriously compelling.
The only small gesture to fairness was the common description in the media of Leaving Neverland as one-sided. But no one stopped to find out the substance of what was on that other side. TV reviewers were very affected by the narrative that these accusers were in love with Michael Jackson, which convincingly justified why they didn't speak up sooner. Everybody seemed to have an opinion on it. People magazine noted how Twitter exploded after this documentary, and all the talk shows were abuzz with discussions about this shocking film. I heard and read many comments about how people could tell Robson and Safechuck's stories were true by looking at them. Viewers said they could see the emotional toll on the faces of these accusers and hear their compelling stories, which was all very convincing. As examples, we're going to share a sampling of some of the many viewer responses from Amazon reviews and from the social information site Quora. They're addressing the question, do you believe the accusers of Leaving Neverland? Here's a few representative responses from these sites.
The two men exhibited all the signs of having been sexually abused. The swallowing, trembling, eye contact, and descriptions of their emotions.
The frightening details that both Wade and James describe are too real-sounding to be made up.
These men aren't lying. There's no way. You can see the pain. They have so much detail.
You can see the pain and trauma in the eyes of these boys.
It blows me away that people can watch this and accuse them of wanting money. Pay attention to the men describing what happened. Look at how distraught they are.
Their body language validates their story.
The speed and certainty of the media and many viewers to accept the stories as true was troubling to me. And with the exception of talk show host John Ziegler, there was virtually no media skepticism of this film. No fact-checking any of their stories before weighing in on their credibility. The media seemed blind to or unaffected by the evidence that Dan Reed bypassed basic journalistic standards in making his documentary, which should have discredited it. Looking back at this reaction several years later, it still astonishes me that the media was deceived on such a massive scale about this documentary. So the topic of this episode is how deception and bias factor into the Michael Jackson allegations, with a particular focus on the Leaving Neverland documentary. Here's the questions we'll be addressing in the show.
What does science tell us about our ability to detect lies?
What steps do deception experts recommend we take when trying to judge if a story is true?
And finally, why did so many people get deceived by this film? We'll start by taking a look at the research and books specifically dedicated to understanding deception.
The Confidence Game, Why We Fall For It Every Time, is Maria Konnikova's highly acclaimed evidence-based book on con artists. She says the research is clear that we're all susceptible to being conned, but we all think we won't be. This is because we're intrinsically inclined to trust, and we're naturally drawn to a compelling story. Konnikova says con artists are master storytellers, and when a story seems plausible, we often assume it's true. And once it's accepted, we're not likely to question it. The con artist takes advantage of our too trusting nature. He evokes our empathy by crafting a story that draws us in, and then we stop thinking rationally. Konnikova writes, "Give us a compelling story and we open up. Skepticism gives way to belief. And despite our deep certainty in our own immunity, we all fall for it."
After discovering Dan Reed's manipulativeness in reordering timelines, deceptively editing audio, and excluding any contrary evidence, I find this description of the con artist matches his filmmaking behavior. Reed carefully shaped the story of abuse and took advantage of his audience's empathy and instinct to trust, with his close-ups of only the accusers and their families. The vivid details and compelling love narrative aroused emotions which led viewers to turn off the rational response to question what wasn't being told in the story.
According to Konnikova, one of the essential traits to being a successful con artist is narcissism, having an outsized ego, where the world revolves around you and you think you deserve a lot. Narcissism is an important trait for con artists because when they take advantage of people, they don't have to feel bad because they think they deserve it. Konnikova says grifters are made when predisposition meets opportunity.
As we discussed in the earlier episodes of this podcast, each of Jackson's accusers or their family members displayed traits of entitlement and narcissism. Evan Chandler, Gavin Arvizo, Wade Robson, and James Safechuck, in their own statements, revealed their jealousy of others getting something from Michael Jackson that they felt entitled to, and expressed indignation that they didn't get more from him.
The predisposition of entitlement in Jackson's accusers, plus the opportunity to gain money and exact revenge, could logically be a part of the recipe for their deception.
Konnikova explains how humans haven't yet evolved to spot lies. Instead, we like to think that we can tell people are lying because it makes us feel better. It makes us feel like we're good judges of character. The number one lesson Konnikova hopes to impart is to make us understand how bad we all are at spotting a liar. With that understanding, she says it will make us better at uncovering deception because we'll stop and take the slower steps to verify claims.
So when looking at Leaving Neverland, Konnikova's research would tell all of those TV critics, talk show hosts, and viewers of the documentary not to judge the claims of these guys based on how sincere or emotionally broken they look, or even how compelling and vivid their stories are. Instead, pause and look beyond their stories and their demeanor to verify their claims and see if they have a record of deceit.
Researcher Tim Levine's work on deception is featured in Malcolm Gladwell's bestseller, Talking to Strangers, and echoes some of the themes in Konnikova's book. Levine says that when presented with someone in front of us telling us a story, we default to truth. We believe what they're saying. This default to truth is generally an adaptive trait, in that it promotes trust in others, which leads to stronger community bonds. The problem with the default to truth comes when someone is trying to deceive you. Levine's research reveals that looking honest has little to do with actual honesty, which explains the low accuracy rates in deception detection, even by experts. He warns that the only time we can really detect lies comes along after listening to the stories, through the uncovering of evidence revealing deception. We can't reliably detect liars through their demeanor.
The viewers of Leaving Neverland only had the chance to default to truth with the stories of Jackson's accusers and their families. But how would the default to truth tendency have played out if Reed had also interviewed Brett Barnes, Macaulay Culkin, Jonathan Spence, and Frank Cascio, who as kids spent much more time with Jackson than Robson and Safechuck?
If there were close-ups of these guys strongly defending Jackson, the reaction to accept the accusations may not have been as strong. These friends could have described their innocent fun with Jackson and how he never tried to isolate them from their families. They could also share personal and specific examples of how they saw families try to take advantage of Jackson's openness and generosity.
And what if Reed had filmed an interview with journalist Charles Thompson about the evidence that these guys lied in their lawsuits? Or if he interviewed Robson's former girlfriend, Brandy Jackson, who not only could describe Wade's sense of entitlement, pattern of opportunism, and constant drive for relevance, but her very existence as Wade's girlfriend, set up by her uncle Michael, damages their theme that Jackson tried to get his victims to stay away from women. If these interviews were included, there would likely have been more doubt in the viewer, more of a back-and-forth pull between sides. Of course, caution about the pitfalls of default to truth should apply to Michael Jackson as well, when trying to assess the truth of the accusations. Watching Michael Jackson declare his innocence on his videotape declarations also shouldn't convince anyone. Even if he looks sincere in his denials, that's not the basis to gauge honesty in someone you don't know well. There are no shortcuts. You need to research first.
Tim Levine's studies showed that even experienced law enforcement agents could only detect sincere-looking liars 14% of the time.
14% accuracy. I find that number to be alarming and humbling.
When discussing his book, Talking to Strangers, Malcolm Gladwell notes that we are all massively overconfident in our abilities to gauge if someone is telling the truth. His message is that we should be wary of that confidence, and that the right way to approach the words of someone you don't know is with caution and humility.
But caution and humility does not describe the media response to Leaving Neverland. Movie reviewers and media commentators simply watched the film, and their public reactions were based only on the film's content and how it made them feel. Their responses were often filled with righteousness and conviction, calling Jackson a monster and belittling anyone who challenged the film. These reviewers and talk show hosts were so sure of themselves when judging these accusations as credible.
Research psychologist Stephen Greenspan confirms that we are all susceptible to being duped and that intelligence and education have nothing to do with it. Greenspan explains his many years of research in his book, Annals of Gullibility, Why We Are Duped and How to Avoid It. In interviews, Greenspan uses himself as an example of how even an expert on scamming got scammed, as he lost a third of his retirement savings in Bernie Madoff's Ponzi scheme. His lesson from that loss has become his recommendation to others to prevent being duped. Don't delegate high-stakes judgments or decisions. Greenspan had short-sightedly relied on the recommendations of others when deciding to invest with Madoff.
When high-profile celebrities like Ellen or Oprah assert their belief in the Leaving Neverland accusations, that's a pretty high-stakes decision, considering the charges of child molestation. When the New York Times or the Washington Post publish articles stating that this movie is convincing and should be seen, that's also a high-stakes judgment. These celebrities and prominent newspapers influence millions because people have trust in these sources. But how do these celebrities and news sources know if they can trust Dan Reed? Reed provided no resources to back up his confidence in his subjects and offered no analysis of the contradictory evidence. And when pressed in his interviews about opposing evidence, Reed often redirects the questioner by saying, "It's all in the film, just watch the film," which is a huge red flag. To me, he's like a magician who doesn't want you to see how the trick works. He just wants you to watch the show and fall under the spell of the filmmaker's illusion. And he knows there's only a small percentage of people who've done enough research to know he's not being honest when he says there isn't contradictory evidence out there. Reed is able to dismiss damaging evidence by saying it's just the crazy Jackson fans or the greedy Jackson lawyers. Dan Reed expects our trust without doing the work to earn it. But Greenspan's advice confirms the recommendations from other deception experts that fact-checking is essential before making high-stakes judgments.
Dan Ariely is a deception researcher who shared his findings about deception in his book, The Honest Truth About Dishonesty, How We Lie to Everyone, Especially Ourselves. Ariely says what separates honest people from not honest people is not necessarily character, it's opportunity. He says that cheating is contagious and that a group's behavior will have a powerful effect on each individual.
This analysis makes me think of the culture of grift and Gavin Arvizo's whole family. But all of Jackson's accusers appear to come from families of opportunists.
The Chandlers, the Arvizos, the Robsons, and the Safechucks were all willing to lie for money. And they were all fully aware of how the people around Jackson were profiting from him, embezzling funds, lying to make tabloid money, and they were jealous of others getting his attention and advantages.
Ariely says with this entitlement mindset, you convince yourself that you are not cheating. You are doing what everybody else is doing. There is also notable research showing the unsurprising finding that social rejection can lead to lying for financial gain. The social rejection leads people to feel entitled and that they deserve their ill-gotten rewards.
Social rejection is also a feeling described by each of Jackson's accusers. They each said they felt rejected by Michael Jackson. Evan Chandler was outraged and indignant that Jackson cut him off after a scriptwriting proposal. Gavin Arvizo, in his testimony, described how he was upset that Jackson cut them off after their first visit and didn't give him as much as he thought he should. Janet Arvizo and her fiancé said how it wasn't fair that others were cashing in on the rebuttal documentary, but they weren't getting anything. Robson and Safechuck, in their lawsuits, both described being upset at being cut out from Jackson's life and watching others get time and experiences with Jackson that they wanted for themselves.
They all felt left out and thought they deserved more. And research shows this rejection to be a potentially powerful force behind deception.
No one has made a more impactful case for caution in our own judgments than Daniel Kahneman. Kahneman was awarded the Nobel Prize in Economics in 2002 for his work, and he's widely venerated for his revelations about how we make decisions and the biases that we unconsciously use every day.
The media makes a big deal over Kahneman because of the universal opinion that his work is important, and people should pay attention. NPR, BBC News, The New York Times, and Time Magazine are among the media outlets who've given Kahneman a platform to expound on these important themes.
In his book, Thinking Fast and Slow, Kahneman emphasizes the message, we all are susceptible to cognitive bias and judging too quickly, so don't jump to conclusions when you first hear a story.
To help us understand our weaknesses in reasoning, Kahneman explains our two thought systems.
System one is fast thinking and jumps to conclusions. It's good for such decisions as what brand of toothpaste to buy or what socks to put on.
System two is our slower, more deliberative thought process that should be activated in higher stakes judgments.
So Kahneman says that for high stakes judgments, we should be using system two, with its slower, more deliberative processing before judging. But what could be higher stakes than an accusation of child molestation? Considering the devastation to Jackson's family, his legacy, and his fans, if this were to be a false allegation, it's only fair that journalists should slow down and commit to figuring out what wasn't presented in Leaving Neverland and honestly weigh that information before making such quick public judgments. But it was System One that was fully engaged in the media, who came out immediately against Michael Jackson.
As an example of System One thinking, here's the first sentence of a tweet from British journalist Lewis Theroux, days after the release of Leaving Neverland.
If you can't see that Michael Jackson was a pedophile after watching Dan Reed's film, you're being willfully blind.
Well, I can't really argue with Theroux's statement. Why wouldn't you think Jackson was a pedophile after watching a film that was so carefully crafted to deliver that message? The Leaving Neverland narrative intentionally leaves no doubt. But viewers defaulted to truth and presumed Dan Reed was being honest and transparent.
Here's the second sentence in Theroux's tweet.
And if you're campaigning against Leaving Neverland, you're actively colluding in the silencing of victims.
Theroux seems to be massively overconfident in the accuracy of this documentary. There's no room in his mind for doubt, based on a story that was presented to him by this one man, Dan Reed, a virtually unknown filmmaker. How could Theroux know if Dan Reed was being honest with his audience? How could Theroux be so confident when he hasn't looked for evidence beyond the film itself?
Kahneman says that if our System One thinking can create a compelling and coherent story, it will suppress the inclination to use our more thoughtful System Two thinking.
Reed did a masterful job of creating a compelling and coherent story of grooming and abuse. Through his manipulation of the facts and by avoiding all contradictory evidence, he was able to suppress any doubt in many of his viewers.
Kahneman also notes that poor evidence can lead to a great story. Knowing less actually makes it easier to construct a more consistent, compelling, and cohesive narrative.
So Kahneman, revered in academia and the media, tells us don't trust a story because it makes sense, and don't trust a story because it's emotionally impactful. But that's exactly what happened with Leaving Neverland. All the TV reviewers used the compelling and cohesive argument to justify their confidence in the film. LA Times critic Lorraine Alley wrote the following in March 2019.
Leaving Neverland is heartbreaking and hard to watch. It's a compelling look at childhood trauma, fame, and the mechanics of pedophilia.
In a New York Times commentary on March 5, 2019, Aisha Harris wrote,
I came away from Leaving Neverland fully convinced of their stories.
What convinced Harris were the explicit details of these stories and the compelling romantic love narrative.
Brian Tallarico, in his review on RogerEbert.com, focuses on how the love narrative makes so much sense regarding the reasons they didn't speak up for so long.
When we're thinking by using System 1, Kahneman says we're incapable of imagining scenarios we aren't presented with. We ignore what we don't know. Kahneman calls this shortcut, what you see is all there is.
So Lewis Thoreau and all the others simply couldn't imagine Robson and Safechuck repeatedly lying and relating impossible stories in their lawsuits. And they couldn't imagine that the filmmaker would place events out of order and deceptively edit audio clips in order to sharpen his narrative. They also couldn't imagine the accusers' mothers would distort the truth to protect their sons. Many of the media outlets that have featured Kahneman and hailed the importance of his work were the very same outlets that immediately jumped to support the stories of Leaving Neverland. The media reasoned in exactly the way Kahneman says not to, by saying the stories made so much sense, they were so vividly told, and the emotional impact was clear. They trusted that the narrative framed in the TV show was reality, and couldn't imagine that reality was so deceptively crafted. The media fell for the "what you see is all there is" bias. Researching the science of deception helped me understand why so many viewers bought into the Leaving Neverland story, but I also want to directly address how cognitive bias played a role.
The psychology literature generally defines cognitive bias as an error in thinking that leads us to misinterpret the information coming at us. Biases are unconscious and can cause us to make quick judgments in an unfair way. They negatively affect the accuracy of our judgments.
We're going to cover 8 cognitive biases that may help explain why viewers jumped to the conclusion that Jackson was guilty after watching this film.
Number 1. The tribalism bias.
Humans evolved in the context of group competition, and groups who were loyal to each other succeeded more often than non-loyal groups. Consequently, biological pressures have sculpted human minds to be tribal, and group loyalty as a basis is found in all cultures.
I saw the effect of tribalism at play in the public figures responding to Leaving Neverland. The drive to be a good member of the tribe clearly outweighed their drive for accuracy. The tribe in this case was public advocacy of sex abuse victims. After a long history of denial, our culture has been going through a moral reckoning over sex abuse. Talk show hosts, journalists, and celebrities understandably did not want to be seen as unsupportive of victims of abuse, which may have happened if they expressed anything but complete acceptance of these stories. This documentary was released at the peak of the Me Too movement. It was much safer for these public figures to immediately support the alleged victims in this particular case, as proof of their general support of sex abuse victims.
Number 2, the bandwagon effect.
The bandwagon effect occurs because of our bias to go with the crowd, regardless of the evidence.
Especially when prominent members of the entertainment world stepped up quickly to get behind the claims in Leaving Neverland, like Oprah did. There was more pressure in the field to get on board. And once the media unified to declare this documentary credible, their readers and viewers followed suit. As an example of this bias, here's Oprah herself, saying how if she were introduced to Bernie Madoff, she may have fallen victim to a scam because of the bandwagon effect.
So Bernie Madoff is mismatched. He's in the opposite way. I don't know if you, did you ever meet him?
No, I never met him.
Thank God I was not invested with him. Yes,
exactly.
Thank goodness I didn't meet him, because I would have been seduced too. You know why? Because I would have thought, well, this person's in it, and Elie Wiesel, such a dear friend of mine, and Elie Wiesel was in. I would have thought, well, if this person's involved and this person's invested, must be a great guy.
Yeah.
You couldn't have all of these outstanding people who also care about their, you know, finances invested with him if they hadn't checked him out. That's what I probably would have thought.
Number 3, the self-interest bias.
We're biased to the explanation that most benefits ourselves.
In the case of Michael Jackson, the child molester narrative clearly benefits the media as it hooks in audiences with its shock value.
For Santa Barbara DA Tom Sneddon, if he's able to bring down the biggest celebrity in the world because of heinous acts, Sneddon's a hero.
Filmmaker Dan Reed has no movie, if the accusations aren't true. And if there's no movie, there's no accolades for bringing to light these terrible acts that were hidden for so long.
Talk show hosts can muse about how celebrity blinds people to bad behavior.
Journalists get to write their heart-wrenching and potentially award-winning stories about coming to terms with the Michael Jackson they loved as a kid versus the Michael Jackson they see now as a child molester.
At the discussion session following the premiere of Leaving Neverland at Sundance, a trial lawyer got up and said how grateful he was for this movie because the publicity will promote changing laws to help sex abuse victims file late claims.
Another example of the self-interest bias is when Oprah hosted a Leaving Neverland special with Dan Reed, Wade Robson, James Safechuck, and an audience filled with survivors of child sex abuse. At the beginning of the program, she encouraged her viewers not to focus on the issue of whether or not Jackson was guilty. She instead emphasized how the story of child predator seduction had never been told so well as in this film. And we should use this story to increase awareness and help others. Here's her words.
And so here's the reason why I'm here. In 25 years of The Oprah Show, I taped 217 episodes on sexual abuse. I tried and tried and tried to get the message across to people that sexual abuse was not just abuse, it was also sexual seduction. So after I saw Leaving Neverland for the first time, I called up Dan Reed, I didn't know Dan Reed, and told him, that, Dan, I said, you were able to illustrate in these 4 hours what I tried to explain in 217. And I know people all over the world are gonna be in an uproar and debating whether or not Michael Jackson did these things or not, whether these two men are lying or not lying. But for me, this moment transcends Michael Jackson. It is much bigger than any one person. This is a moment in time that allows us to see this societal corruption. It's like a scourge on humanity.
Oprah is a huge advocate for child sex abuse victims, and she can use the publicity surrounding Michael Jackson to draw attention to a cause that's important to her. Oprah closes her Leaving Neverland special by repeating the same caution to viewers not to get hung up on the did he or didn't he question.
The reason to tell the story, because the story is bigger than, as I said at the beginning, it's bigger than any one person. Yeah. And don't let anybody in your world make it just about what Michael Jackson did or did not do. It's about this thing, this insidious pattern that's happening in our culture.
No one in the media brought up the obvious ethical implications of Oprah's statement. Just like the prosecutors with their tabloid paid eyewitnesses during Jackson's trial in 2005, Oprah is basically saying credibility doesn't matter when it comes to the Michael Jackson allegations. In effect, she's saying it doesn't matter if the reason this film tells such a perfect grooming story is that it's fiction, because the story serves a larger purpose to draw attention to a worthy cause. There are much more dramatic articles, talk show subjects, and self-interest publicity, if the accusations are taken as credible, versus taking the unexciting position to not comment until you have more information.
Number 4, the illusory truth effect bias.
This is the tendency to believe false information to be correct after repeated exposure. Daniel Kahneman tells us that a reliable way to make people believe in falsehoods is repetition, because familiarity is not easily distinguished from truth.
There's no question about the potential for familiarity bias in the case of Michael Jackson, where accusations of child molestation have followed him since the 1993 allegations. Tom Sneddon, police detectives, and the media have always controlled the narrative surrounding the allegations. They all repeat the same refrain, "He sleeps with boys, he sleeps with boys. What else do you need to know?" But Michael Jackson followed his family's tradition of not responding to negative stories. The Jackson family believed you shouldn't dignify the stories or give them attention by responding. This meant Jackson completely lost control of his narrative in the media. You'll hear more about this in season 2. The family's approach to the media rumors put Jackson at a great disadvantage in terms of public perception of his guilt.
And although there are exceptions, most of the books about Michael Jackson are sensationalist and tabloid, with the goal of entertaining people with poorly sourced juicy stories, so there's little to counter the media narrative of Jackson as a molester.
The phenomenon of the Me Too movement also plays into the familiarity bias with the Michael Jackson allegations. When we saw one celebrity after another fall from grace because of accusations of sex abuse, Leaving Neverland came out in early 2019 when Me Too was at its height. It was easy to lump this familiar story in Leaving Neverland that Jackson used his fame and money to abuse boys into all the other abuse stories in the media.
Number 5, the confidence bias.
The confidence bias is when we give more credibility to people who speak with confidence. Deception research says we are all too trusting of confident people, and that we should be very cautious about this, because confidence does not mean truthfulness or accuracy.
We can see this oversized confidence in the public appearances by filmmaker Dan Reed, by District Attorney Tom Snedden, and by Prosecutor Ron Zonin. They all present themselves with smug and sometimes intimidating certainty in their assertions of Jackson's guilt. But if you're trying to honestly weigh evidence, it would be a mistake to give their words more credibility because of their overly confident demeanors.
Number 6, the entertainment bias.
This is an offshoot of the self-interest bias.
The entertainment bias is of particular concern to me because of how I've regrettably seen it play out in my own actions. When I watched the Netflix docuseries Making a Murderer, I was taken in quickly with the engrossing story of how police mishandled the murder case against Stephen Avery. I felt angry at the injustice of keeping this obviously innocent man in prison, and this outrage was a topic of conversation shared among my friends. All the evidence put forward by the filmmakers pointed to a wrongful conviction in the case of a young woman's brutal murder. What's uncomfortable for me to admit is that I waited to research this case until after I finished the entire show. It's my habit to research and verify what I hear about in the news, but in this case I waited until I saw the whole series before diving in. I wasn't conscious of it at the time, but I now know that the reason I waited is because I didn't want to weaken the entertainment value of the program. It's more entertaining TV if the evidence is clear, there's nothing to doubt, and I can be outraged at a wrongful conviction. But when I finally researched the evidence, I found a good deal of defense-damaging information left out of the show. I felt the discomfort of being manipulated. I felt my trust had been betrayed by the filmmakers when they left out such important evidence. I wondered why more journalists didn't voice their skepticism about Making a Murderer, reportedly seen by almost 20 million people. I found one excellent piece about the show by Catherine Schultz in The New Yorker about the lack of journalistic integrity in withholding critical evidence from viewers. In her commentary, Schultz warns us about these one-sided documentaries, which can go on air and be so readily accepted. The following passage from Schultz's article resonates with me when I think about the manipulations in Leaving Neverland. Here's her words.
We still have not thought seriously about what it means when a private investigative project, bound by no rules of procedure, answerable to nothing but ratings, shaped only by the ethics and aptitude of its makers, comes to serve as our court of last resort.
Schultz highlights that what's a tragedy to the family and friends of the young woman who was murdered is entertainment to the public. I think it's important to consider the entertainment bias in the viewer response to Leaving Neverland.
Number 7, the bias of narrative transport.
Related to the entertainment bias is the bias of narrative transport. In order to persuade the viewer to believe a fictional narrative, the filmmaker needs to get the audience fully immersed in the story, feeling empathy and identifying with the characters. When a viewer is fully immersed in a scripted feature film, the story gets encoded in the brain as if it was a real experience, which is why we cry during fictional movies like Forrest Gump or Beaches.
Vivid imagery and compelling storytelling help this emotional transport. Leaving Neverland uses close-ups of the accusers with their vivid and shocking descriptions of sex abuse.
Dan Reed also uses music and imagery to help his audience transport into the narrative of Jackson as a child molester.
We see the imagery of Michael Jackson transforming into a monster from the Thriller video to suggest a darker, sinister side of Jackson. And while Wade Robson explains on screen how Jackson's music set him on fire and made everything tingle, the viewer watches footage of Michael Jackson doing pelvic thrusts.
The point of this narrative transport is that you feel as if the story you're watching is real, and you react emotionally as if it is real.
When I look at the reviews of Leaving Neverland and compare them with reviews for dramatic feature films, often the same descriptors are used: powerful, riveting, and compelling. Here's a few examples of reviews for scripted dramatic films.
In describing the 2019 movie version of Les Miserables, the LA Times calls it compelling and terrifyingly real.
Roger Ebert's review of Schindler's List says it's powerful and haunting and brought him to tears.
In CBS Philly's review of 12 Years a Slave, the movie is described as powerful, wrenching, important, and while difficult to watch at times, urgently and breathlessly compelling throughout.
But these movies were filled with actors and behind-the-scenes professionals working hard to immerse their audience into the story and provoke real emotions to things that didn't really happen to these actors. How do we know Dan Reed didn't use the tricks of filmmaking and narrative transport to compel his audience into believing a story that wasn't accurate? Leaving Neverland could at the same time be a compelling, vivid, and important story about grooming and abuse, and not be true.
In his review of Leaving Neverland on RogerEbert.com, Brian Tallarico says it's not his job to research facts, it's his job to review movies.
So it appears he's using the same criteria to rate Leaving Neverland as he would a scripted fictional film. Can you identify with the main characters? Is there a cohesive story that ties up all the loose ends? Does it take you on a journey emotionally? Do you leave the theater powerfully impacted?
There was no mention in any of these reviews about how Leaving Neverland measured up to documentary standards and how that failure should impact our responses. If the documentary filmmaker has done a good job of presenting a compelling story and suppressing doubt by leaving out any counter evidence, and if, as Tallarico says, it isn't the reviewer's job to fact check, it appears that movie critics will likely accept a narrative at face value and move on to judging it based on the same parameters as a fictional film, such as how immersive it is.
Number 8, the facial anomaly bias.
People often perceive anomalous faces as less trustworthy, and researchers have dubbed this effect the anomalous is bad stereotype. The anomalous is bad stereotype may have evolved from traits to promote healthy mate selection and to minimize risk of communicable diseases. These researchers point out that facial anomalies are used in pop culture as a shorthand for moral corruption, such as in Voldemort, the Joker, or by naming the villain Scar in The Lion King. People expect worse character traits from people with facial anomalies, and researchers suggest that dehumanization may be to blame in these attitudes.
Michael Jackson was vilified and mocked in the media for the whiteness of his face and the shape of his nose, without any regard or respect for the underlying diseases that affected his facial appearance. His vitiligo removed the melanin in his skin, making the whiteness of his face extreme and unlike typical white skin. His cutaneous lupus caused significant barriers to proper healing after his scalp and nasal surgeries. His lupus also caused ongoing breakdown of Jackson's facial and scalp tissue.
Jackson's distinctive features made it easy for the media and the public to dehumanize him and conflate his anomalous looks with sinister behavior once the allegations surfaced. If there's one thing that's known for sure about deception, it's that people cheat and scam about everything.
According to the Pew Research Center, 1.6 million people cheat on their taxes each year.
According to ETS, the organization which administers the SAT exam, over 4,000 SAT tests each year are not accepted because of suspected cheating by high school students.
The National Healthcare Anti-Fraud Association estimates that healthcare fraud costs our country about $68 billion annually.
According to Federal Trade Commission statistics, Americans lost $300 million from romance scams in 2020.
From the FBI's Elder Fraud Report, over 100,000 seniors were defrauded out of over $1 billion in 2020.
College admission fraud, financial scams, infidelity scandals, cheating in professional sports, cheating scandals in schools. In every industry and institution, there are cheaters.
Even in the animal world, there are cheaters. For instance, there are bees that cheat flowers out of pollination by chewing a hole in the base of the flower to get at its nectar. This eliminates the mutualism between bee and flower.
Cheating and scamming are an unwanted but unavoidable aspect of our society. given any opening for a dishonest reward. There have always been some minority of our population willing to cheat and scam to take advantage of the opportunity. So when it comes to Michael Jackson, if he was innocent and naive when he allowed families access to his personal space, you should expect that some minority of these families would take advantage of this vulnerability and try to cash in.
And even though it would be very shocking to find out these accusers would lie about such acts, it's important to remember that we're shocked all the time by the dishonesty of others.
We see deception stories in the news every day because people find them so captivating and gossip-worthy. Some of the most popular podcasts and TV shows in recent years have centered on individuals who deceived others with devastating consequences, such as Elizabeth Holmes, Larry Nassar, or Bernie Madoff. It's notable how many podcasts are out there that are completely dedicated to liars and manipulators. The Grift, American Scandal, Liar City, Perfect Scam, Con Artist, Lie, Cheat, and Steal, Swindled, to name just a few. The popularity of these shows and the media commentary about them reveals how we are shocked and captivated every time we hear a news story of deception. How could Madoff be so heartless to run a scam that would wipe out the life savings of so many people? How could Theranos founder Elizabeth Holmes look so sincere and confident when pitching her clearly faulty blood test? She not only defrauded many investors, but put lives at risk when people made high-stakes medical decisions based on the results of these tests. It's shocking to realize the many ways people can lie and cause so much hurt to others. We're also repeatedly surprised that many of the deceived are well-educated and otherwise savvy citizens, such as former Secretaries of State George Shultz and Henry Kissinger, who became involved in the Theranos venture, or Steven Spielberg and Elie Wiesel, investing with Madoff. Part of the fascination with these deception stories is imagining if and how we too could be deceived. Many viewers of Leaving Neverland didn't consider the possibility of being deceived because they couldn't imagine that two men would go on TV and falsely describe being sexually abused, causing much pain for their families and others. But according to deception research, this is the wrong way to think about it. People who have the traits that predispose them to conning, like entitlement and narcissism, compounded by feeling rejected, use the opportunities they're presented with. Robson and Safechuck were in despair over their life circumstances, financially, maritally, professionally. The potential prominence, sympathy, and financial gain of making these allegations may have been seen as their one ticket out of a desperate situation. We know that motivated liars carefully plan their lies down to the last riveting detail. And we know that Jackson's accusers and their families have all been caught being deceitful. So no matter how emotional their stories are, or how familiar, or entertaining or plausible, or how helpful to a larger cause, it's the deceit that needs to be examined and understood before making a determination of truthfulness. If we pay attention to the experts in deception science, there's a better way to react to Dan Reed's one-sided documentary. And that would be to pause, admit ignorance, and reserve judgment until there's a chance to honestly assess opposing evidence. So to wrap up this episode on deception science and how it relates to the Michael Jackson allegations, I'll reassert my position that the media and the public were deceived by the Leaving Neverland documentary through the influence of cognitive biases and the natural human instinct to default to truth and fall for a compelling story.
And that concludes our episode on deception science as it relates to the Michael Jackson allegations. We only have one more episode to go in season one. In this final show, we'll be consolidating the evidence from Jackson's four accusers and present our summary of evidence so far. This season one finale will come out in 2 weeks instead of our usual weekly release. But that's only the first part of the podcast. In season two, which will be released later in the year, we'll present the personal side of Michael Jackson that supports the case for innocence.
You can find all our source material on our website, michaeljacksoncaseforinnocence.com, and you can reach out to us through our website or on Twitter at @case4innocence.
Thank you for listening to the Michael Jackson Case for Innocence podcast.